WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, it's Obama's war now, as the president who got us out of Iraq authorizes airstrikes to get us back in.
I know that many of you are rightly concerned about any American military action in Iraq, even limited strikes like these. I understand that. I ran for this office in part to end our war in Iraq and welcome our troops home.
So coming up this morning, the president invokes the G word, genocide, plus the logic of bombing to protect Americans who Obama didn't have to send in the first place. Also today, the newest conference in the NCAA, the Rich Kids Conference, why some colleges will now be allowed to spend more on their athletes, but others won't. Plus, we'll compile your list of secret sanctuaries, the quietest places in New York, and the so-called news you love to make fun of will explain the origin of Shark Week. But first, today is the 40th anniversary of something that has only happened once in U.S. history. The President of the United States resigned from office.
I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, to my family, my friends, to many others who joined in supporting my cause because they believed it was right, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me. Because all of us, in the final analysis, have been concerned with the good of the country, however our judgments might differ.
More than the usual two lines that have been replayed in the last day or so from Richard Nixon's resignation speech, about a minute's worth, August 8th. 1974. Our first guest today was a player in forcing Nixon out. Elizabeth Holtzman, who went on to be Brooklyn DA and New York City Comptroller, was a congresswoman from Brooklyn and a key member of the House Judiciary Committee, which held impeachment hearings. So we will look back and also at how Nixon's resignation affected the politics of possible impeachable offenses by President Bush and this new impeachment chatter about President Obama. Hello, Elizabeth Holtzman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian, and hi to your listeners. It's wonderful to be back with you.
On this day that President Obama has authorized new airstrikes in Iraq, maybe without explicitly asking Congress, the last U.S. president not to bomb Iraq now becomes Ronald Reagan. But am I correct that your original articles of impeachment against President Nixon were less about Watergate and more about Nixon's bombing of Cambodia?
No, the original articles of impeachment that the basically a group of Republicans and conservative Democrats crafted to win bipartisan support and were basically covered Watergate, the abuse of power, and the obstruction of justice. That was kind of like an indictment for criminal conduct. And third, the president's refusal to respond to subpoenas of the committee, the obstruction of the impeachment process itself. Then there were other articles of impeachment offered, one dealing with taxes. None of those additional articles were supported by the committee. They won a number of votes, but not a majority. One of those articles had to do with taxes. Another had to do with emoluments. The president had used public monies to improve his homes, properties, and so forth. And the final article, one that I drafted, had to do with the secret bombing of Cambodia, which was the president had ordered the bombing of Cambodia without the approval of Congress and never disclosed it. In fact, kept a dual set of books so that neither the public nor the Congress could understand that bombing was taking place in Cambodia. That bombing may well have led to the Khmer Rouge, the rise of the Khmer Rouge, as some people argue.
It is incredible to think that a president of the United States could keep bombing a secret, never mind not going to Congress for authorization, keep actual bombings of places a secret. And if you don't mind, let me linger on that for a minute, because we all know about the resignation over Watergate, and we'll talk about that too. But I was fascinated over the last day being reminded of and reading back into again your interest in Cambodia as an impeachable offense. And after Nixon was gone, Congress passed the War Powers Act as hopefully a corrective to Presidents Johnson
Nixon
and Nixon.
Nixon was still in office. Because Nixon vetoed that bill, and the War Powers Bill was passed over his veto.
Right. And so to act as a corrective, I guess, to Johnson and Nixon doing things like that without getting Congress to declare war, as the Constitution gives them the power to do. So can you reflect on that debate and how Nixon's resignation may have affected war powers going forward?
Well, there were many things that led to Watergate, even though Watergate itself was a – I'm going to give you a long answer, Brian. I'm sorry. Even though Watergate itself was restricted to a burglary of the Democratic National Committee headquarters and the use of vast presidential powers to cover it up, it was embedded in the context of – an arrogation by President Nixon of huge war-making policies and huge presidential policies. So people were kind of, startled, I would say is the mildest word you could use, for the president's claim that he didn't have to spend money that Congress authorized, that he could shut down an agency of government, that he had unilateral power to bomb in secret, so the impeachment was in that context, and the resignation was in the context of a country that was very troubled about the arrogation of presidential powers, not just Watergate. You're right to raise the issue of Cambodia, because it was actually the secret bombing of Cambodia and the leak about that bombing that caused President Nixon to create a secret White House group of operatives called the Plumbers, who engaged in various kinds of break-ins and illegal activities, including the Watergate burglary. So it's ironic that that Cambodia, in a way, played such a central role in triggering a whole host of illegal activities. And if you look back, I can understand why Congress did not, or the Judiciary Committee, did not vote on that article of impeachment about the president's arrogation of power and abuse of power by secretly bombing a country, not just once or twice, but systematically. I think they thought at that time it would seem political. The other articles seemed so much clearer, normal. It wasn't none of those crimes were really political crimes. They all sounded like normal obstruction of justice, suborning perjury, tampering with witnesses, that kind of thing. So I can understand it. But the problem has been that the country has increasingly gotten into trouble when presidents have arrogated power in the area of foreign affairs and national security, particularly the war-making powers. Whether you take President Bush's, what seemed to me, misuse, deception of the Congress and the American people, misuse of his powers, and defiance of the framers of the Constitution's view that war should only be undertaken when you had a dialogue between the president and the Congress, and therefore dialogue between the president and the American people. So that was thumbing his nose by President Bush at the Constitution and going to war in Iraq. Now we had a bombing of Libya where the American people were and the Congress was not consulted, and many. You can see that there were many grave questions about the wisdom of that action. Sometimes two heads are better than one. That's what the framers of the Constitution thought. While many people may approve now of President Obama's action, people may say, well, why not formally consult Congress? And why not use the idea that two heads are better than one and that it's important when we risk the nation's money and lives that Congress be consulted? So you can say that the failure of Congress to act way back when either set a bad precedent or reflected a deeper reluctance on the part of the Congress to check the president's powers in the areas of foreign affairs and national security.
And I'm so grateful for that long answer because I think people don't know, very few people know, how the leaks regarding the Cambodia bombings led to the formation of the plumbers who became known as the Watergate plumbers to plug those leaks. And it's such important as well as fascinating history for people to hear. My guest is former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. If you want to talk to her, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And just one more thing on that point before we get back to explicit Watergate history. We did see what I thought was a remarkable and maybe historic moment a few months ago when President Obama and the UK were about to start bombing Syria, but the British Parliament took a no-confidence vote on the idea, and then the U.S. Congress seemed ready to follow suit, and the bombing was called off in favor of the chemical weapons deal with Syria. And I know we're straying from Nixon for the moment, but did you think that was an important moment of Congress asserting itself on war powers that could set a precedent?
Yes, I think the failure to consult in the end was not a good idea, but I think President Obama got a message and certainly did not want to go. Whether he was concerned about getting approval or not, I don't think he wanted to go into Syria without the approval of, without the participation of Great Britain. He didn't want to go it alone, and Great Britain couldn't do it because of their parliamentary process. In some ways, we can see an atrophy of Congress. I mean, that's another whole subject. Congress challenged on a bipartisan basis, which is an extraordinary thing to consider today, the President of the United States and forced his resignation. How? By going through a very fair, thorough, and meticulous process of adducing the evidence of constitutional misconduct and abuse of power. Today, Congress barely challenges the President. And yet you see in Great Britain, in some cases, much more vigor in the parliamentary system than we seem to have here. Remember, Great Britain did undertake a major investigation of the Iraq War and its participation in it, only held up because the U.S. refused to turn over documents about how about President Bush's participation in that. But we have undertaken absolutely no inquiry into the Iraq War and its origins and the deceptions and so forth. So there is a contrast, and it's troubling.
So getting back to history, and this is, if you're just joining us, the 40th anniversary of the resignation of President Richard Nixon, and we're talking about it with former House Judiciary Committee member who was a key in investigating President Nixon's activities, former Brooklyn Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. You mentioned the role of the Republicans as well as conservative Democrats in crafting the Watergate-related articles of impeachment that did ultimately contribute to forcing the president to resign. What was the role of the Republicans? Because things are so polarized today along partisan lines. It's hard to imagine, you know, things not just breaking down about along. He's our guy. No, he's your guy. What was the role of the Republicans at that time?
Well, you know, it may well be. No, I don't recall any head counts being taken, and I don't recall many polls, if any polls, being taken. So part of this was striking out without the normal political paraphernalia
that we think about today.
Yes, I mean, who would ever? But in any case, who would ever think to do that today? But what happened was that, and it was a little bit what happened in the Senate committee too. There was a before the House Judiciary Committee sat on impeachment, which was triggered by enormous public outrage over the firing of the Watergate prosecutor. There was a Senate committee that was formed to uncover the facts of Watergate. That was also a bipartisan committee. It started out with Republicans being supportive of the president and Democrats being a lot more questioning. Howard Baker, in a very famous question, said, "What I need to know is what did the president know and when did he know it?" He thought that that would exonerate President Nixon because he believed President Nixon didn't know anything at all.
Huh.
Well, by asking that question, he began to get answers that showed that President Nixon was deeply involved. And it was that committee, by the way, that uncovered the existence of the White House taping system, which was crucial in the impeachment process against President Nixon. So people may have started out with their own preconceptions, and it was true on the Senate side as well as the House side, but the weight of the evidence was so enormous that basically any fair-minded person, someone who was not acting in a partisan way, you know, would be very persuaded. And I would say that, I mean, when I talk about Southern Democrats, at that time, we did have Southern Democrats, and their committee, their constituents, were probably even more supportive of President Nixon than some of the constituents of the Republicans on the committee. So the support of the Southern Democrats was just enormous. Once you had the Southern Democrats and the moderate Republicans who in the end decided the most important thing was the good of the country, and they really did take a political risk. All of them took a political risk. People from South Carolina, from Alabama, and Republicans from Virginia, from Illinois. I mean, they took a risk that their constituents would be pro-Nixon and would be partisan in the response. And I applaud them still today for their courage. But they put the country first. It is, I mean, I think all of us deep down put the country first. But for them, it wasn't just, I'm going to put the country first, a slogan. For them, it was a real political risk. So the fact that they were able to craft this and pull this together meant that we had really a very substantial number of Republicans, almost a third of the, maybe more than a third of the Republicans, supporting all of the Democrats. And ultimately, the Supreme, so that would have won, in my view, there would still have been an impeachment and a conviction in the Senate. But what really led to Nixon's resignation was the fact that shortly after the House Judiciary Committee voted for the articles of impeachment, the Supreme Court ruled that some Nixon tapes that had been withheld had to be turned over to the Watergate grand jury and to us. Once those tapes were made public, those tapes showed Richard Nixon from the almost day one orchestrating the cover-up of the Watergate break-in. At that moment, the holdout Republicans, every single one of the holdout Republicans, joined in saying that the president should be impeached.
Wow.
So you had a unanimous House Judiciary Committee, and there was no way that the House of Representatives would not, in light of that, have voted for his impeachment. And then in the Senate, maybe there would have been one or two holdouts in both places, but he would have been convicted in the Senate and removed from office. There's just no way he could have withstood that. And I think the reason for his resignation is that these events took place in August. We're in August now, and you have a November election coming up, And the Republicans got really scared, the leadership of the Republican Party.
The midterm congressional elections.
Correct. They were really worried that that if they had a trial, you know, first of all, there'd be a vote in the House of Representatives in September, early September. And then you'd have a trial in October of Richard Nixon with all this overwhelming evidence and the tapes of his involvement and orchestration of the cover-up right, you know, during the election. There was a rout in terms of the number of Republicans who lost in November anyway.
Right.
But you can just imagine how many of them would have been removed from office if Nixon had stayed in power. So I think it was a huge effort.
Such
to
push
him out of office at that point.
By the Republican leadership. That's so interesting.
Right.
Fascinating history. And including the detail, which I didn't know about Republican Senator Howard Baker being the one to frame that famous question, what did the president know and when did he know it? And that rather than that being an implied accusation, which is, I think, how it tends to get used when that question is asked now about anybody, it was with the presumption that it was going to emerge that he really didn't know anything himself.
Right. It's show me the beef. Where's the beef kind of question. And it came out, but it wasn't the answer he expected. But to his credit and to the credit of most of the Republicans on even the Senate committee, just as a major number of Republicans on the House committee, they said, well, here are the facts. Regardless of partisanship or party, I'm doing the right thing.
So after the resignation, President Ford pardoned Nixon for all possible crimes. Your House Judiciary Committee held hearings about that. And didn't you ask President Ford if the pardon was a quid pro quo?
I did. I asked him whether there was a deal about the pardon, and I got a filibuster answer. Well, he did deny it, but...
What kind of quid pro quo were you thinking of?
Well, let's just look at the fact. If you wanted Richard Nixon out of office to make sure that you didn't have a complete rout of the Republican Party in the midterm elections, you wanted Richard Nixon out of office. You didn't want him hanging around for a trial and a conviction and all of that, you know, even more disgrace and affecting the election. So you can easily see that that could be a factor. You can say, too, some people could say, well, you know, Richard Nixon wasn't going to leave and Ford wanted to be president, so maybe there was a deal to make him president. Remember, the context of this is not just the Watergate proceedings that are taking place in the House Judiciary Committee that took place before that in the Senate. You had a Watergate grand jury that was meeting on the crimes committed in connection with the cover-up.
Mm.
And there had been an indictment issued by the Watergate grand jury, and they wanted to indict Richard Nixon as part of the cover-up, along with his top aides. They were told, the grand jury, that they couldn't indict a sitting president. So Richard Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator. So Richard Nixon was definitely facing the possibility, after he left office, that he would be prosecuted for the crimes that his top aides went to prison for.
Robert in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC with former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Congresswoman, isn't it true that Nixon did not know, did not participate in the original break-in that he started? Because you said he was in it from the beginning, but he only got involved in the cover-up because he felt sorry about the people who he felt were doing this for him.
Well, first of all, we don't have enough facts to know whether or not he was involved in the break-in. When I said he was involved in the beginning, I said the beginning of the cover-up, from the beginning of the cover-up. He orchestrated the cover-up. He never said at all anything about any compassion for anybody. He was concerned about his neck, and he was concerned about winning the November election. Remember, the break-in took place in June, and the cover-up was orchestrated, and a lot of it took place in October. Again, we're talking about the political calendar here. Richard Nixon wanted to be reelected, and he was very concerned. The break-in was a member of the opposite political party, the leadership of the opposite political party, and the cover-up had to do with ensuring that Richard Nixon would be reelected. That was key part of it. And sure, he liked his top aides, but that wasn't the reason that he orchestrated the cover-up. He wanted to be reelected, and he didn't want to go to prison.
Ernst in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Yes. I was saying that I'm an immigrant. I was never more proud of America than when Nixon left office. I couldn't imagine the most powerful man on the planet being told, you have to leave, and he left. I can't imagine any other country in the world where a person has the kind of power an American president had and had during Nixon's era. And he was told, hey, man, you got to go. And he left. There was not one soldier on the street with live ammunition in his weapon to try to keep him in office. America stood tall that day for me.
Ernst, thank you.
Yeah, let me just say that's really, I think, a very important point, that the framers understood, the framers of the Constitution put the impeachment power into the Constitution. Why did they do that? Because they understood that even though we had elections every 4 years for president, that during those 4 years, presidents could engage in illegal conduct or improper conduct or abuse power or threaten the democracy. And the way to deal with that was to have a very cumbersome, difficult process, but a process that could lead to the removal of the president. The president didn't have to resign. He would have been removed by the Congress through the impeachment process, but he didn't want the disgrace of that, and maybe there was a deal over the pardon. Who knows? But I think it was a sign of people say Watergate was the low point in American history. I think it's a high point because it shows the democracy worked and the Constitution worked, and I think the caller is exactly right.
Another moment like that for me was when Gore conceded the presidency to Bush after that contentious and contested Supreme Court decision. In some other countries, people may have taken to the streets, and he reaffirmed the rule of law, even if you don't agree with what the judges come out with. And I don't know if that was completely analogous to Nixon or at that level, let's say, of import, but that struck some of the same chords in me about the peaceful transfer of power and the rule of law in this country. The end of Nixon, and we have a few minutes left, was not the end of your interest in impeachment. You drew up and published in a book and in the Nation magazine articles of impeachment or a citizen's guide to impeachment against George W. Bush. And wasn't that based not so much on the Iraq war itself or torture, but on the warrantless wiretapping of the Bush administration?
Yes, one of the people think about Watergate and they think really about the break-in and the cover-up of Watergate. But as I alluded to in my comments earlier, Nixon set up this plumbers operation and was involved in a lot of abuses of power. The plumbers not only were involved in the break-in and Watergate, but they broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to get information to smear Ellsberg about the Pentagon Papers release. Nixon also ordered secret wiretapping that was illegal of some of his top aides, as well as of reporters and journalists. And that was one of the grounds for impeachment, the misuse of the power of his office by wiretapping, by illegal wiretapping. And I really, maybe I was naive, but I thought once Congress had voted for these articles of impeachment, or once the Judiciary Committee voted for the articles of impeachment, and it had won such wide public and scholarly support, that no president would engage in this conduct again. And then when I saw that George Bush acknowledged wiretapping people without a court order, and the numbers of wiretaps were huge, I said, I can't believe this is happening all over again. And we've been through this, that president can't take the law into his own hands and can't engage in wiretapping or other uses of power outside of the law. And so I began to look into that, and I felt that not only was there an impeachable offense with regard to the wiretapping, but with regard to the violation of the torture laws as well and the starting of the war.
So now that we have Edward Snowden's revelations, should Obama be impeached on the same grounds?
It's unclear. This is a much murkier situation because I think that President Obama has claimed that all of the wiretapping that is engaged in now is legal. And it'd be very difficult to uncover enough facts and to understand the complexity of the law to make an argument that it's illegal. If it's illegal, then I think that this president, like any other president, should have to stand scrutiny. I can't answer the question about whether it's legal. I think they have made a very strong argument that the wiretapping is legal, and Congress has gone along in many ways with changing the law to allow the wiretapping to take place. So Congress has been complicit in the aggrandizement of presidential powers and has continued this trend of backing away from examining it. And I just want to say one other point. The claim of national security, that's a claim that Richard Nixon made over and over again. I don't want to release the tapes because they all have to do with national security, he said. The wiretapping all had to do with national security. Well, these were just blatant falsehoods because the actions that he was taking that were quote-unquote national security had to do with just a criminal cover-up. And the wiretapping, well, one of his aides had gone to work with his political opponent, Edmund Muskie, in Maine. And so it was a handy way to get information about the Muskie campaign. So we had to be very careful when presidents claim that they can't release information because there's national security involved. I always take that with a grain of salt because many times, at least Nixon showed, that claim was abused and it was made to cover up crimes and the claim was made to cover up mistakes and embarrassments. It was not genuinely a national security interest.
Fascinating. So final question. Now we have chatter in Washington about impeachment of Obama for his executive orders without Congress on health care and immigration and other things. Being as familiar with the politics as you are, and we've heard that throughout this conversation, if the Republicans take the Senate in November, do you think this could get real?
No, because I think just as you saw with regard to Clinton, you can't have impeachment in the end unless the public supports it. Because as that gentleman said, we had a change of power with no guns on the street and no rifles. If the American people think that this is political and unwarranted under the Constitution, the impeachment and the removal from office will never take place. Yes, can the House of Representatives impeach? They might, because the Republicans control it. But you need a two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict, and I don't think that will happen, because so far, from what I know, the president's refusal, for example, issuing executive orders is not a ground for impeachment. The president has a right to issue executive orders. I don't know how many presidents have issued them, but Obama certainly wasn't the first, and he's not going to be the last. The question is, what do the executive orders allow, and is this an abuse of power or a power grab in some way that's contrary to the rule of law? I think with regard to immigration, the president has the perfect power to make decisions about priorities with regard to law enforcement. I was a DA. I couldn't prosecute every single case in Brooklyn of issuing a false check, a fraudulent check. I couldn't have prosecuted the murders if I had to take that kind of action. So every law enforcement official makes priorities in terms of where you're going to devote your resources. You can't possibly prosecute every single criminal offense that takes place. So the argument that's somehow an impeachable offense, to me, just from my own experience, is just nonsense, and the American people won't stand for it. With regard to the Affordable Care Act,
and we have 30 seconds.
I don't see that there's an impeachable offense there either. I think it would be seen as political, and I think it would be wrong for the Congress to do anything like that.
On this 40th anniversary of the resignation of Richard Nixon from the presidency of the United States, we thank former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who was a key member of the House Judiciary Committee, which was looking into the question of possible impeachment at the time. Thank you so much. This has been so, so interesting. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks to your listeners.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.